And welcome into episode 19 of Best Dance in Baseball. I'm Daniel Shopdaw, that's Dan Buffo. We come to you here with no baseball going on at all. It's the first time that we've come together since the World Series ended. Dan, I guess that's as good a place as any to start. The Royals win in five. You know, and I think everybody's going to remember this is the Royals series. But heck, I mean, the Mets could have easily taken that series. I mean, they lost two games and, you know, gave up a lead in the ninth twice and had another game where they had a lead. You just wonder if they were a little bit more confident with their bullpen. Maybe things would have been different. But Kansas City's such a tough team.
They are. And, you know, Kansas City, I mean, they're a frustrating team. They played up the game like Whitey Herzog's Cardinal teams in the 80s played. I mean, they take the extra base. They steal. They, you know, they'll hustle. I mean, you saw Lorenzo Cain score from first on seemingly a single because, as you read about afterwards, because the third base coach for the, you know, for the Royals paid attention to Jose, or, you know, wait a minute, that was the ALCS.
Yeah.
But just things like that where you got their coaches breaking down other teams. You have their you know, their team, you know, even, I mean, for a team that doesn't really have a lot of big boppers, just a lot of good hitters. You have those kind of things that beat you. And I think, you know, their coaches and their team did the same thing with the Mets. They just kind of slowly broke them down, especially Jacob DeGrom. And, you know, they knew if they can just get to the Mets bullpen, because really the Mets, for as good as they are, they have a little bit of a gap between their starters and Familia. At least it was shown in this series how Terry Collins had to really figure out how to get from his starters to his closer. And how it imploded. But it's just those things. And, you know, when I read that before the World Series started, I thought, man, these coaches are into it. This team is just tough. And they're the Royals. They're also a team that, you know, people kind of forgot about down the stretch because they didn't have the greatest second half. But then they come into the playoffs and they just fly by these opponents. And, you know, they frustrate teams. They beat up teams with good pitching. I mean, and their pitching found a way to shut down. I think the biggest key of this series was the fact that Cespedes and Daniel Murphy were shut down. I mean, that's two of their biggest bats. Daniel Murphy came into the series being unable to not hit a ball hard, and he hit under 200 for the series. Cespedes didn't have a lot of big hits. David Wright had a big hit or two, but for the most part, they really shut down the Mets hitting, and that just leaves you with that great pitching. While Noah Syndergaard, you know, he pitched. I mean, I think Harvey pitched the best game overall. Syndergaard was very fairly good in his game, strong, but the Royals didn't get shut down by their pitching, and they made the best use of their time when they got to the ninth inning, man. I mean, as you just pointed out, the Mets had leads in the late innings, three out of the four losses they had. They really did give away those games. I think the biggest culture shock for the Mets was when Familia gave up the home run to Alex Gordon in game one. I think that really just kind of told the Mets, wow, this team's kind of a, you know, because if the Mets win that game, it could be a whole different series, but when you're lights out closer, who's not giving up anything, gives up the big late bomb to Gordon, and everything kind of changed. I mean, the attitude of the Royals got picked up. The series wasn't over by a stretch, but you just got the feeling that maybe the Mets, you know, their powerful stance after sweeping the Cubs, it shrunk, and the Royals just kind of took advantage of it. They took advantage with their hustle. I mean, I watched this team, and they're just fun to watch because they don't really have a lot of power, but they frustrate you on the bases.
Yeah, it was just, I mean, somebody had the list out, tweeted it out somewhere along the way of percentages that to winning, you know, I don't know how to say this, but their odds of winning, I guess, and like seven or of the postseason games, they had a chance at one point in time or another of the game, had 20% or less chance of winning, including a couple of those were single digits, including, and they came back and won the ball. And that just seemed to be the thing. If Kansas City found that crack, found that opening, they pushed on through it. You know, a very relentless team, and a team that, you know, does take on that devil magic mantra that seems to apply to the Cardinals a lot. The Cardinals have had some situations like that. Obviously, we remember some games where they've rallied like that, but I don't think they've ever done it as consistently as the Royals did. You know, used the joke on Twitter in the game five when the Mets took that 2-0 lead, got an extra run. The joke was that they just increased the Royals' chances of winning. And it turned out that was pretty accurate because, you know, that they give up two runs in the ninth. Now, you could argue the Harvey thing quite a bit. And I think that just shows you they didn't have a guy that they trusted in the seventh and eighth. Because I think if they had, they might have. I know Harvey wanted to be out there. We've seen that with Adam Wainwright. We've seen him, you know, 2 years ago when they were playing Pittsburgh, and he had the shutout going in the it was one of those things where he hurried out to the field before Matheny could even think about stopping him. You know, and that was kind of the idea with Harvey there, that I think he took it into his own hands. But, you know, on the flip side of that, and if it works, it's a great story. But it doesn't work, then you get that idea of who's running the clubhouse. And we've had that discussion with Mike Matheny a number of times. You know, is he letting the players run the clubhouse, or is he got to make the tough decisions?
Well, yeah, and especially with the Jaime Garcia thing. I mean, you know, if Jaime Garcia, I mean, guts it out in that game too, then we're all talking about how great he is and how he's turned the corner. But when he doesn't, then we just go, Mike Matheny shouldn't have let him start.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of that. I mean, and it's even when somebody's going well, you know, like Harvey was going pretty well, but he was getting up there in a pitch count. And again, it wasn't like he was going out with a 4-0 lead. I think a 4-0 lead, yeah, you let him go out there and you let him lock it down. But yeah. 2-0 lead, you know, obviously, he, you know, two batters later, it's 2-1, and the runner's on, you know, tying runs on second. That's a tough place to bring in a reliever. I don't think you can blame Familia too much for that.
No.
And so it was just a situation where, you know, like you said, the Royals got good pitching, and they got good enough pitching to just stay in ball games, and eventually they were able to put those rallies together. Like I said, it is a lot like the 2011-2012 Cardinals, but they did it more regularly. Cardinals had two, three games maybe like that. The Royals had, you know, 8 or 9. And like you said about Murphy, I figured he was going to come back to earth, and I think that just kind of, I mean, boy, that just kind of tells you how good of a postseason David Freese had in 2011 when he had such an awesome run against the Brewers and then was able to follow it up with such another great run through the World Series.
Yeah, he never really cooled off. He was steady, and then he kind of saved his best for last. I mean, he even had that big hit in Game 7 against the Rangers. But yeah, Daniel Murphy, I mean, it's just one of those things where he started the playoffs off on a thing where any pitcher couldn't touch him. He was hitting against the Dodgers, hitting against the Cubs. But then he just went from, you know, greatness to like just flopping against the Royals. And, you know, the error he made, it can't be really passed up. You know, if he makes that play, maybe the whole game could be saved. And it just kind of compounds everything. But it's just one of those things where the Royals, I mean, they get into late innings and they're just a frustrating team to play, because if they reach base, it's like you're playing against like 8 Billy Hamiltons. I mean, they get on base and they just find a way to get to second. They find a way to get to third. You know, they have players that just go first to third on a single no matter what. I mean, there is no discussion. You even need a third base coach. I mean, they're going there. And that really puts a lot of pressure on a pitcher. And for me with Harvey, I think, you know, when we allowed the first guy to reach, I think that was Collins calling to go get him. And when he left him in, and then, you know, the double happened. And like you said, I mean, you bring a reliever in there, though, there's already a fire on the mound. I mean, you're asking him to put something out that's going to be really hard to put out, especially against that kind of a team. And, you know, Familia, the only really game where he really meaningfully gave it up was the home run to Gordon. All the other games, it was bad defense, or it was just, you know, a chip here, a chip there, maybe a walk. But, you know, Tyler Clippard, you know, walks those guys before he comes in the last game. It's just a fact that if you open the door for the Royals up, they're just going to smash the door open. And that's kind of what they did the whole series, with the exception of the game they lost. He just never felt like they were out of it. I mean, even if the Mets were getting good pitching, you know, they're shutting them out. Okay, everything's pointing good. You know, they're in New York. The crowd's going crazy. Nothing seemed to affect the Royals. And on that kind of a stage, that just tells you what kind of team this is, that people thought they were going to write them off as just a one-year wonder. But here they are. They're back on that big stage, and they seem to learn from it. I mean, if you don't forget, I mean, in last year's World Series, I mean, they had a tying run on third base. I mean, it was a Game 7, and it was huge, and they got really close. This year, they took down similar pitching, if not better, and they just pushed it over there. And I think they learned from last year's World Series how to really, you know, maintain their hitting, maintain their pitching. And really, I don't think there's a National League team that really kind of hung with them, because they're just that kind of tenacious team.
Yeah, and you know, the World Series trophy is back in Missouri, just got delivered to the wrong side of the state. So Hopefully next year that can be corrected. But and I guess good for the Royals. They finally get a World Series that isn't tainted for the first time in their career, first time in their history. So I guess good for them. I had a friend that was a Royal fan. I had a friend that was Mets fans. It didn't bother me either way. I thought it would be a better series than it was. And honestly, I mean, you look at some of those scores and you look at the fact it was over in five and it doesn't look like it was a good series. But there were, pretty much all but that game. I think it was the game three that the Mets won 7-2. Pretty much every other game was fairly close. And like we said, the Mets lost a number of them in the ninth. So. It turned out to be a pretty good series. I thought it'd go a little bit differently, but good for the Royals fans, and they're not listening to the show anyway, so it doesn't matter. All right, let's move on, because as soon as that last out is made in the World Series, the hot stove opens its doors, and we start loading up logs and getting ready for the off season. Cardinals have done a little bit of house cleaning this week. They non-tendered Pete Cosma. They released Ed Easley and Travis Tartamala. They also declined the option on Jonathan Broxton. Those are the guys that are gone. And then none of those, I don't think any of those surprises. And that also doesn't mean, again, let's be clear, because a lot of people try to rejoice at the end of the Pete Cosma era. Pete Cosma has gone through this procedure before. It basically just gets these guys off the 40-man roster. Doesn't mean they can't re-sign them or put them in the minors again after they've cleared waivers, all that kind of stuff. Not saying that they're out of the system completely, but I don't think any of this was a huge surprise, any of those four. Do you?
No, I think it was just kind of business as usual, kind of just getting the parameters kind of set for the big action. It's just, nothing really popped out to me. I mean, as far as, when you kind of outright guys, it's kind of like a nice way of saying, okay, well, we're just going to designate you for assignment, see where he picks you up, and if not, you'll be right back in the Cardinal uniform. For Cosma, I mean, I don't think anybody's going to pick him up. As far as him making any contribution next year, I kind of hope not. It's just what there's people in the system that need to play. He does need to be on the Cardinals, but as far as declining the options of Broxton and the other couple moves, it didn't really Ed Easley and Tartamala, those are guys that I just think that the Cardinals don't value enough to protect anymore. They put Anthony Garcia, a young Cardinal outfielder in the minor league system. They put him on the 40-man to protect him. So it's just one of those things where at this time of the year, the Cardinals, I think that they want to protect certain prospects, so they kind of put certain ones off and see if anybody picks them up, like Tartamala, Easley, and Cosma. It doesn't mean teams are going to go, oh my gosh, I've been waiting for Ed Easley to get available, now I can go get him for Easley. It's not like that. It just means that there's kind of – it's kind of like they're sitting on the bench at Greyhound, and the Cardinals could just go, okay, come on, let's go, get back on the bus. But it's one of those things where it wasn't a lot of surprising moves. I mean, they didn't acquire David Price this last week.
Right. I guess I was just a little surprised they got rid of Easley and Tartamala. Not that.
Yeah.
I mean, just because I didn't expect them to clear that many off. But I mean, those kind of catchers are kind of a dime a dozen. Even if you don't get those guys back, you can get guys that are similar. To fill your minors, and they still have Michael Ullman on the trail, so there's three catchers on the 40-man. It's not too surprising. I wasn't expecting both of those guys, but
yeah,
it made sense. Now, the Cardinals did add somebody to the 40-man roster today, and that's Anthony Garcia, completing the Garcia hat trick now with Greg and Jaime. I know that he's had some good stuff, some good reports. I haven't had a chance to see him much, or haven't, just kind of a name that's kind of come out over the last year or so. Do you know much about him? I mean, I know you keep an eye on the minors maybe a little bit more than I do.
Yeah, there was Jennifer the Ghost wrote about him today about being added there. He's basically a guy that he's 23 years old. He just made the jump to AAA. He had an impression at Team Puerto Rico in the Pan Am games in the summer. This season, he's a guy that started off as a catcher. Now he's a full-time outfielder. He's a guy that could be seen maybe as a serious guy in camp, maybe next year, maybe the year after that. But he's one of those guys that made the jump from AA to AAA. I mean, combined, he hit 283, slugged 477 over the 105 games. I mean, he had 26 doubles, 13 home runs. He had as many eyes as strikeouts, so he's not a, he has a good eye. And according to Lugosz, this was his first season above Class A, so he's kind of finally starting to make that climb. It could be somebody the Cardinals value as a guy maybe in 2017 if they do in fact trade an outfielder or two. This guy can kind of come into the fray as like a, you know, the, like the next Tommy Pham, the guy that could, you know, could do a lot of things. He's got a little bit of power, as you can see. He's finally making the jump. As you said, he's a guy that started off as a catcher. He's an 18th round pick out of Puerto Rico in the 2009 draft. So he's been around for a while, but he's only 23. So he's still pretty young. And I think this season is really where he really started to put it together, because as you can see, he moved from Class A to Double A to Triple A. So hopefully he's a guy that maybe starts off hopefully again in Memphis. Hopefully he hits well there again. He could be a guy that can come up and make a contribution if there's some injuries, but he's definitely going to be a guy that the Cardinals are trying to protect. I think that's one of the reasons why they kind of shoved some guys off that 40-man in order to put on Garcia and protect him so other teams can grab him. He's definitely a guy who's starting to make that rise.
Yeah, you know, as it says right now, the 40-man after that stands at 33, so there's room. You know, you got to have some room for guys like this. Like you said, I believe he would have probably been eligible to be taken in the Rule 5 draft, which is probably why they're adding him on here.
Yeah, she did point it out. She said they're beginning the process of protecting players from that Rule 5 draft.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That was definitely a move.
Yeah, and there may be some. I don't remember who else that they've said. You know, Alamedes Diaz will probably get put back on there.
Yes.
Play that. I think there'll be a couple others, from what I understand. Plus, you have to have room for, you know, adding free agents and such of that. So, you know, and one guy that's on there, I'm going to transition a little bit, because, like I said, it is interesting that they're protecting Garcia, because he's had a good season. But, you know, it's another outfielder, so it's not likely we're going to see a whole lot of him. Like you said, he could come up in the middle season and fill in like a Tommy Pham, but it seems pretty unlikely we'll see him until September call-ups, if everything goes as expected, you know, if they re-sign Hayward and things of that nature. But, you know, let's switch gears then a little bit now and talk about another Garcia. Jaime got his option picked up this week. 11 or 11.5 million dollar option for next year. Again, you know, we've had discussions about it in the round table, and I know you've got opinions on Mr. Garcia, but you know, it's hard to say, hey, you're a left-handed pitcher that had a very good year and you're going to make less than the league average, we're going to let you go. That was just not going to happen.
It wasn't. And you know, and most of my frustration with the guy is that he is a very talented pitcher who didn't leave fans with the most unsour taste to lead a season with his abbreviated start in game two, how he had the stomach virus. He didn't tell Matheny that. I fault Matheny as well. He did have a season. It's one of those things where maybe it's one of those things where I kind of want the Cardinals, you know, this team needs a lot of change and they need to start shedding their old skin. I thought he was a move. As far as them picking up the option, it wasn't surprising. I guess it's just kind of one of those things I just kind of go, meh. I mean, it isn't like I'm really bad enough in the guy. I think he's dynamic when he's healthy, and you know, it's just the fact that he hasn't made more than 20 starts. He's kind of a liability. His shoulder seems to be finally found after the last late May when he came back. He had the hamstring, but I guess it's you know, it comes down to trusting him. It comes down to trusting his body. He's going to be 30 years old. He's kind of getting up there. But as far as yes, the 1 year, 11.5. If he does what he did last year, he's worth it. I mean, nobody can go against that, not even me. I guess it's just a part of, you know, if the Cardinals are going to go after a guy like Price, I thought maybe Garcia wouldn't be coming back, but I think it's business as usual to kind of go, okay, we'll bring him back. And then, as I noted in my response, I think they could possibly flip the guy in a possible trade. I mean, he does have that nice, comfortable salary. He does have that easy option the team can pick up. He's a guy like Matt Adams that I kind of see as a floater this offseason. If Mo wants to make a big move, he could flip one of these guys into a trade. But no, it was a no-brainer to have a guy making 11.5, even with his injury history, even with the fact that he didn't end the season on the brightest note. When he's on, I mean, he's one of the best left-handers in the National League, if not the game. He's just he's a filthy pitcher. I mean, for a guy who only made 20 starts, he had a 3.9 WAR for the season. You know, he had a He's a guy that can just dominate. He had a 163 ERA plus. That just basically adjusts that to the league average in your ballpark. It's kind of like OPS plus, and that is an insanely good number. So even if I have my qualms about his health and what is he possibly going to give, you just look at that number of 163 plus. I mean, for a comparison, I mean, Lance Lynn and Walker were in the 130s and the 120s. So when he's on, he's great. It's just the fact that, you know, 4 years and counting, he's been kind of a liability for being fully healthy. But I wasn't surprised by it. It's one of those things you just go, okay, that's business as usual. My thing is to be, does he last the full season with the Cardinals, or does he get flipped out in a trade?
You know, I will say, I mean, one, you know, having a guy that's a lefty like that can be so dominant, that's not something the Cardinals have a whole lot of right now. I mean, they've got some left-handed pitchers that could come up, you know, like a Gonzalez or a Cooney or something like that, but they're not guys that are just going to necessarily dominate. They're more the crafty lefty type, I think. Garcia can really dominate, and so obviously he can be a huge asset for this team. But, you know, I do look at him and I say, you know, he is got to be one of the more valuable trade chips for Mo this summer. I mean,
he is winter
because of his, you know, one, he's proven he's at least a little bit more durable. He's gone through a year without any arm problems.
Yeah, I mean, that's the first thought that came to my head. I thought, okay, now we got him back, but now we can flip. Got a very comfortable salary, nice, easy option. That's the first thing I thought about.
Yeah, and I think that option is the big thing because you're trading a guy that not only do you have him for, you know, 2016, but you have the chance that if he has a good year, you pick him up at $12 million, which is still a very, very reasonable salary. So you get him for 2 years at a very good price. Or if he gets hurt and he stinks or whatever, you just, you know, you pay the option and you go on. You know, I think this is a guy that the team should be asking Mo a lot about. And so whether he will do it or not, you know, obviously I'd still like to see a David Price signing. So if that happened, you know, that cleared up the room for him. But there's no guarantee that David Price is going to be even that much better than Jaime Garcia. I think that.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, I mean, if you look at fan graphs, I mean, Steamer's got him projected to pitch in 26 games, so they're optimistic. And you know, with a good ERA and he's winning 10 games. You know, Jaime Garcia, I mean, I got excited about the guy coming in October. I thought, here he is. He's finally healthy again in October for the first time in 3 years. And you know what? If he pitches better in October, I'm probably like, yeah, let's bring him back. But that's just what one bad, nasty playoff start can do for you. Because it connects back to 2012 when he pitched with a bad shoulder. It's one of those things that can really throw off your thing. Because and maybe my judgment is not fair. Maybe, I'm a guy, I wrote two articles about the guy the week before he made the playoffs. They're like, okay, we're finally get to the good Jaime, the guy that any lineup can't solve, the guy that's filthy on the road at home. Because when he is healthy, he's dynamic. I mean, there is no home and road splits with Jaime. There is no, oh, can he shut these guys down? I was hoping that, you know, that since he was facing this Cubs lineup for the first time in 2015, I thought he was going to carve him in half, and then that didn't happen. And if you think about, okay, well, what if a scenario is where he didn't make that start, he pitched in game four, and he pitched better? Maybe we're all thinking a lot better. Maybe I'm thinking a lot better. Sometimes in sports, it's that one start, that one game that you just kind of get kind of swayed by. And it's not fair. I mean, the guy's finally healthy for the first time in 3 or 4 years, and he goes into a playoff start, you know, with a very bad stomach ache. I mean, I can't even really walk from the kitchen to the couch with a bad stomach ache. This guy's not trying to pitch a start of a playoff game. So maybe we're not judging him fairly. But then again, also that comes back to him and Matheny. You know, if he tells Matheny maybe more than an hour before the game time, hey, I it's not like I need some Pepto. It's like, you know, I haven't slept well in 48 hours. But yes, I mean, as far as if he is healthy, I mean, $11.5 million. I mean, the Cubs were playing Edwin Jackson that had to come out of their bullpen this past season, are pretty close to that. I mean, you know, I mean, a pitcher's salaries are just ridiculous these days. So if he pitches great, even if he does what he did in 2015, he's worth it. But I do think that he's a big trade chip and a guy that can kind of be the golden part of a trade in that, you know, if a team is getting, you know, for $11.5 million, and I think the option's the same for 2017, I mean, that's a very affordable thing. Especially right as he's turning 30, maybe he pitches great, maybe he gets that big contract he's been wanting to get. So I think of him more as not really what he's going to do in a Cardinal uniform in 2016, if he actually makes it there.
Yeah, I mean that's the biggest thing. We just don't know that he's going to be a Cardinal, but he easily could be. And right now, I think you plan for him to be, but I'm sure that Mo entertains some discussions now.
Yeah, because the rotation is really set now. If nothing else happens, I mean, as far as you have. You have Carlos coming back. You got Waka. You got Lynn. You got Waino coming back. So you have, so really your rotation is set. That means, that doesn't mean Mr. Mozell can't rock the boat a little bit.
Yeah, I mean the rotation's set. You've got
Marco and Cooney kind of Marco as a sixth and seventh. And Lyons, if they, even though I think Lyons should be in the bullpen, if you ask me.
Well, I think Lyons is going to be because he's out of options, so he's going to have to be unless there's a situation again in spring training where. You know, somebody gets hurt and they have to fill it for
there.
There's
a guy that I want to discuss that Mr. Nagel brought up. His name is Dean Kiefer. Or he's kind of a loogie down in Memphis. I think he's a guy that I've been kind of looking at as far as who could replace the Choate role. I mean, this is a guy that John Nagel, he can find at Cardinals Farm on Twitter. You know, when we were discussing left-handers, he kind of brought this guy up. And, you know, this guy just had a very filthy – so I guess I'm jumping ahead. I'm not already jumping ahead to who's going to pitch in the next season. But, yeah, this is a guy kind of caught my eye a little bit.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny because, you know, I'm working on the exit interviews for – at my blog, and I'm going through all the players. And I've got one – I think it's Mitch Harris tomorrow. And I'm trying to pull it up now, and things are not going the way I wanted to. But Mitch Harris – and it's small sample size. Let me get you know – you know, he only had the 1 year. He only had the partial time. But Mitch Harris was very, very tough on lefties last year, which is a little bit of a reverse split. You know, you wouldn't necessarily expect that out of him. But, you know, and again, like I say, I don't know his I'm not, you know, looking at his minor league splits or anything like that, so I don't know if that's just the luck of the draw or whatever. But, you know, he struck out more than half of his strikeouts came against lefties, didn't allow a single extra base hit against left-handers. I mean, he was very effective against them. And Harris is not a guy that I think we want to see in a longer role. I mean, if Harris is on this team next year, he should be like that sixth inning guy in the game that you're already losing. I mean, I don't think anybody wants to see him out there with the game on the line. But, you know, maybe that's a situation where you look at that. Now, the Cardinals have said they don't really want to go with a Loogie next year, that they're going to use probably like Tyler Lyons or somebody else, that maybe there's an inning where a tough like Rizzo's coming up in that inning. They might let Lyons pitch the whole inning because he can face righties and lefties. I'm much more for that. I'm not for a Lyons being a Loogie just because.
Oh, yeah, not at all. And it's worth noting that this guy in Memphis, his name's Dean Kirkheffer. He's a 26-year-old lefty who was just death on left-handers last year. Held him to a 1.54 ERA. I mean, he shut him down. He usually pitches, looking at his last 10 games, he pitches one or two innings, at least two-thirds. So he's a guy that I'm kind of can't keep an eye on. I mean, Nagel told me about this guy 2 weeks ago, and I've been looking at him ever since as a guy that can make an impact on that bullpen. He's 26 years old. He's been in the minors for a little bit, so he's one of those guys. You know, he came out of the 36th round in 2010, so he's not really going to be notarized as far as being ranked in a baseball prospectus or in any kind of minor league rankings. But he's a guy that I'm kind of looking at as far as, you know, if they want to start get some new blood in that bullpen. This guy, Dean Kiefer, I'm probably shredding his last name, but if you go on Memphis's website, you can look at his stats, and they're very good as far as they want to bring somebody new in.
We want to bring somebody old in. We want to bring Jason Hayward back into this mix.
Yes, because, we do.
The Cardinals, I believe it's tomorrow. The Cardinals have to extend their qualifying offers if they're going to do that. Now, obviously, Jason Hayward gets a qualifying offer because the Cardinals, I don't think they wouldn't want him for just 1 year, but if he came back for 1 year and 15-something million, they'd be in pretty good shape. That's not going to happen.
No.
And John Lackey is up for a qualifying offer. Now, there's some differences of opinion on whether the Cardinals make that offer. And before we get into Mr. Hayward, let's talk a little bit about Lackey there. Do you extend that? I think it's $15.8 million. If you extend that with the idea that he might take it, But if he doesn't, then at least you get a draft pick out of the deal.
You know, I've heard so many different things from people that write the bloggers that tell me that there was some kind of handshake deal between the Cardinals and Lackey, but I've never been able to find it in print, even from Derek Gould. I think Gould maybe kind of talked about it, but it was never really cemented that, you know, with Lackey pitching for just $500,000, even though they upped it to a little bit over $1 million with some bonuses.
Yeah, maybe they
wouldn't extend him. But, you know, for the Cardinals, I mean, unless that took place and they're genuine about it, I would extend it just because, I mean, you're going to make, I mean, Lackey's going to have to think about it because that's going to affect other teams wanting to give him a big contract, have him lose that draft pick. I mean, if he happens to go to the Cubs, imagine if the Cubs have to give the Cardinals a draft pick for signing John Lackey. And I think if he takes it, you bring him back and you make an adjustment because everybody would love to have another year of John Lackey without having to give an extra year or a third year. I think that's the big thing. I mean, if there was a way that he would take a one-year deal, the Cardinals would love to have him back just because he's been there, he's done that. He was a big boost to this Cardinal 2015 rotation after Wainwright went down. But it's just a sticker that he's going to be due for a 2 or 3 year deal, and there's going to be a team that's going to give it to him out there. But I think you do extend it now, unless there was a handshake deal. But since that's not really official and we don't know anything about it, I mean, maybe the Cardinals, when Lackey told them that he would pitch for that $500,000, maybe that was part of the handshake deal. But that's the only kind of handshake thing where I heard about Lackey, as far as the Cardinals when they made that trade in 2014, that he would pitch in 2015 for that salary. But you never know. Maybe there was some change to it. But yeah, I think if there's nothing there, I think you have to extend it just because, I mean, even if these two guys walk, if for somehow Jason Hayward and John Lackey walk, you got two really good draft picks. And the Cardinals, as a team that's emptying their system out right now, as they transition to the major leagues and go up to Memphis, and I think you have to extend an offer, a qualifying offer, to Hayward's a no-brainer, but also to John Lackey, just because you're going to influence where he goes when you offer him that qualifying offer.
You know, I think the qualifying offer, and more than that, that the team's avoiding players because of the qualifying offer, is a little overblown. I mean, I know teams are doing it, but you got to look at this. I mean, like if the Cubs want John Lackey, I mean, they're getting a draft pick that's going to be what? I mean, the Cardinals are going to be 30th, and the Pittsburgh's going to be 29th, and the Cubs are going to be 28th. If you're giving up on the 28th, pick in the draft, you know, it's not huge. I'm not, especially not in baseball. I mean, if you don't have the top four or five picks, it's more about, you know, your scouting and your things of that nature, I think, than it is, just going after all this talent. It's not quite like basketball. So, if the Cubs want him, I don't think they're going to hesitate to go get him because obviously he can push them over the top and win a World Series. They're not going to worry about that 28th pick. And then if he goes to a team that's struggled, that's got a higher pick, those top 10 are protected. So you're looking at a second round pick for those teams. So, even then that's even better. So, I think that teams do put a little bit too much weight on that. If they think John Lackey can help them, they should sign John Lackey, no whether qualifying offer or not. Doesn't mean that that's what's going to happen. And it's very possible the Cardinals said, hey, we won't extend you that and hopefully help your market. But, the Cardinals had no obligation to give him the bonuses that they did this year. And I think that, like I said, I think he got wound up with like $2.5 million in bonuses plus the five. So, I mean, granted, that's still way below market value especially for what Lackey gave him. But it's, a lot of that whole thing talk this year is always pitching for the league minimum. Well, not quite. I don't think the Cardinals would want to tie their hands in that regard. So I still think that they'll offer him. If they don't offer him, it is probably because they had an unwritten agreement that they wouldn't. But I think they do, and like I said, if he takes it, great. You figure it out. You trade somebody else, whatever. But most likely he turns that down because you're right. Somebody's going to give him a 2-year deal. Somebody gives him a 3-year deal, I think they get – I don't know that he can make it 3 years at the level that they're going to be expecting him to. But another year, maybe two, that's probably reasonable.
I think it's one of those things where I think the team's going to do it just to get him over another team. you have two teams offer him two-year deals, and one team's going to offer him a third year, and just kind of take that, okay, he's not going to make it 3 years, but we're just going to give it to get him for these first two. But, yeah, I mean, I can definitely see that with the draft pick. I think I can see the Cardinals offering it or doing the qualifying. I can also see him not. I mean, is, you know, there is the possibility that he might go, you know what, I like St. Louis. I want to try winning a World Series. You know, I can go year to year, a guy's confident in his ability. Maybe he takes it. And then all of a sudden you got to figure out, do you have a six-man rotation, or do you try to really seriously think about packaging Taime Garcia into a trade? So I think the Cardinals are going to consider all those options. And I still think you do. But, I mean, as far as them doing it, I mean, it's more of a 60-40, 70-30 thing. I don't think it's a done deal they're going to do. But I think if I was Mosaic, I would offer it to him, because if he accepts it, that's great. You're going to get John Leckie for 1 year, and at 15.8, you know, it's low liability. If he doesn't take it, you at least get some kind of draft pick.
Yeah. Now, obviously, the one that's going to focus, a lot of people are going to focus on, is Jason Hayward, who said we get extended. This is something, as you and I were talking a little bit before we came on the air, something we're going to have to be watching probably for a while, some time. It seems unlike, maybe winter meetings, early that week of December, whatever that front week is, 6th, 7th, 8th, whatever, that whenever they're down there in Nashville. That would seem to be when I think that gets done. That's when Albert's deal got done in 2011 with the Angels. A lot of big names signed then. It would seem to me that's probably the earliest we could get, and it may go later than that.
Yeah, it's just so hard, but it's a very big... It's a very big situation for both teams. The Cardinals, the whole offseason is going to be dictated on what kind of deal they give Hayward, if they get him, if they don't get him. So they're kind of in a holding pattern as far as the big moves. You know, because if they don't get him, they have to kind of switch their gears to a guy like Chris Davis, David Price, other guys. So it's kind of one of those things where it's a big situation. It's not something either side's going to jump to. I think they each made it clear that the Cardinals really want Hayward back, and Hayward really likes the Cardinals. But if I'm your Jason Hayward, this is your big deal. I mean, you're 26 years old. This is your 7 or 8, possibly 9 year deal. It's going to carry you for the biggest chunk of your career. I mean, your deal after this is probably going to be a 1 or 2 or 3 year deal that takes you into retirement. So it's one of those things where you really want to get this right. You love St. Louis, but you also know that other teams win too. So if you're sitting from, you're playing devil's advocate for other against the Cardinals, you can say, you know, other teams have a winning formula. Other teams have a good farm system. Other teams are competing. I mean, you know, I mean, look at the Mets. The Mets came from being like, you know, kind of a laughing stock to all of a sudden being competitive just with 1 year and the right moves at the deadline. And the Cubs did that too with the manager and a few great new players and great talent. And they kind of went from the end of the division to the front and into the playoffs. So it's one of those things where I think there's a lot of options out there for him. I don't think he's going to jump to any conclusions. I don't think it's going to last into the new year. But I do think I'm with you. As instead of saying it was going to happen in mid to late November, as we all know, Mosaic likes to work quick. Mosaic likes to have his deals done by the time he cuts into that turkey at Thanksgiving. I mean, that's just the way the guy works. He's a guy that he knows what he wants. He calls the agents. He gets it done. So by the time the football starts on Thanksgiving Day, he's done. But I think this situation is going to be a lot different because he's got a pretty big fish here. He's got his biggest offseason project since Matt Holliday. So it's one of those things where I think it's going to take a little bit of time.
Yeah, I mean, the Cardinals need this could be an off season that's kind of pivotal for the Cardinals. It's, you know, the last couple of years Mo has just needed to fine tune a little bit. You know, he went out and got, you know, it, a little bit more than that because he lost Beltran, but he went out and got Peralta. He got a few things that people weren't necessarily expecting. But this year, it feels like it could be a really transformative off season, a chance to revitalize the core of this team, a chance to revitalize the offense, a chance to, you know, really put a new face on that. I mean, if Jason Hayward just by himself could be, you know, the face of the franchise for the next 7-8 years, and then that's not, you know, and we talk about that, and we talk about Jason Hayward, and we also talk about the offense still needing something else. Doesn't mean that the pitching staff won't be. I mean, is it trades? Is it whatever? So it just seems like Mo's just not going to be able to do things quite as quickly as he might like. And that's good for us because it means we've got stuff to talk about You know, last few years we've been done by Thanksgiving. We still have to cover, you know, December and early January to figure out something to talk about, and it's really very difficult. So we appreciate Mo, you know, taking a little bit more time this year and giving us a chance to do a little bit more.
Definitely. I think this is going to be a different one just because it is kind of one of those years where you just saw the Cardinals kind of get knocked down by the Cubs. None of the Cubs are going to come back and be like division champs for the next 5 years. I mean, it's going to be a battle between the Pirates and the Cardinals and the Cubs because they're all built very strong and built very young, and they have, you know, good GMs, good coaches. But, yeah, it's one of those stories. So the Cardinals, they really have to figure it out because if they don't get Hayward, and people, you have to think that way. You can't just think that – I mean, we can think all day that, okay, he's coming back. But the more I think about it, the more you have to be ready for the fact that maybe he doesn't come back. It's not a guarantee. The Cardinals have to start thinking, okay, now do we want to change the identity of our offense? Do you want to go out and get a guy like Chris Davis? Do you want to get that big bopper? We were talking today in the UCB roundtable via Doug Vollett's UCB question about what is your dream catch? And we had Bill Ivey toss out Bryce Harper. I tossed out Giancarlo Stanton, you know, Nolan Arenado from the Rockies. I mean, guys that could just change this lineup. And I will point out that Giancarlo Stanton makes $9 million next year. Just going to put that out there. But it's one of those things where, you know, if Hayward doesn't come back for some reason, you have to really think about, okay, what do I do now? Mozeliak's going to have a plan B, but is that plan B going to be to just get another player that fits into that Hayward-type mold? Or do you go out and get a guy like Alex Gordon, who's a free agent and who's been a six-war player? He's got some pop. He just, you know, helped the Royals win a World Series. You know, I know he has a plan B, but it's like when you start thinking about what is his plan B, that makes for a great discussion because if you don't get Hayward, is it necessarily pointing to Chris Davis at first base and Piscotty in right? Is it a guy like Alex Gordon, Justin Upton, or do you try to go for a big trade? It's a very intriguing conversation, and it's one that you can probably soak up 4 hours of a podcast with.
You know, people talk about Davis. They talk about, well, they haven't talked about Gordon just yet, but they probably will be. But the problem with both of those guys, as far as I know, is that, and I know definitely with Gordon, I believe the same with Davis, is that we Cardinals would have to give up a pick. And we've seen,
yeah.
I mean, not that that's going to necessarily hold them back. Again, I've said that if they, you know, I've said people tend to make more of that than they are, but Cardinals have done what they've done by doing good drafts. And I don't think that if they could get a pick back from them, from Lackey, maybe. But I think they'd rather have two picks than just one. So I have problems being that there are questions around, like, Chris Davis especially. Now, maybe Alex Gordon is a guy that you would worry about if you needed an outfielder. But I think the biggest thing is how Hayward seems to fit into the culture of Cardinals. I've made this point numerous places, numerous times. I just don't see another organization out there that would seem to fit Jason Hayward as well as the Cardinals. And I mean that in all facets, not only financially, but, you know, expectations and fan base. And, you know, I don't think he wants to be the face of the Yankees and all that comes with that. I don't think he wants to be the guy that's dealing with the Red Sox, you know, and that fan base. I mean, I don't think that's him. And again, as we've said also before, we just judge what we know from interviews and what we see. It's not like we have any inside knowledge or anything or ever have been in the same state as Jason Hayward, except for ball games, I guess. But I feel like that St. Louis is the best overall package for him. And they're going to be able to be competitive financially because of the new ticket. So I have problems believing he's going to go anywhere else. Doesn't mean that it won't happen, but it might. Now, the Cardinals also have until Friday at 4. I think that's when the qualifying offers are due. But they also have that time to make a bid on a Korean free agent. Name is Byung-ho Park. First baseman, slugger over in the Korean League. The idea was that he might be like Kang from Pittsburgh. So I don't know. I mean, the Cardinals have been trying to do some scouting, trying to look at different ways to get players into this organization. It'd be kind of interesting to see if they went and at least put in a decent bid and went that route, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, they made a bid on Kang that they just kind of came up short with the Pirates. I don't think Mozaik was really putting 2 feet into that. I don't think he was taking a full swing because they were a little bit, I guess, weary of the transitional period for those players. But looking at what Kang did and affecting the Pirates in a big way before his injury, yeah, you have to take Park very seriously. The guy hit 50 home runs in consecutive seasons. Kang has said that the guy is a big power bat. He's a guy that can come to the Cardinals for not a ridiculous price. I mean, you be bringing a guy on that you're, it's kind of like an exercise. I mean, it's coming a guy that who can really affect the Cardinals in a number of ways. He can give them a first base option. He can give them that cheap alternative that they don't want to, you know, give big money to Chris Davis. They don't want to give big money. If they want to make another move after Hayward, I mean, this could be a very comfortable move, a guy that they can bring over and transition from something that's really, well, kind of unlikely to make a huge impact if you look at it on the broad surface. But when you look closer at what previous guys have come over and done, and like I said, the snap-quick effect of Kang last year for the Pirates, who, I mean, he just kind of came out of nowhere and made a big impact. Yeah, I mean, Park's the guy you really have to look at because he could be a nice little alternative for Mazzal to do.
Yeah, it's going to be kind of interesting to see. I mean, the Cardinals have not been a team that has done a lot in international signings. We all remember So Taguchi. You go far enough back, and maybe farther back than you can go, Rene Arocha. The Cuban defector that came in and then the Cardinals signed him, didn't have a whole lot of success. You know, mediocre. It wasn't anything terrible, but not a whole lot of success there. And the Cardinals have done a good job of really trying to make sure that they know what they're doing now. Not only in the draft, but then taking that and being able to put dollar values, accurate dollar values, on people from the Dominican, from Cuba, from Korea. And things of that nature. And if they feel like they're a little bit more confident with what they're going to get out of this one, Park, then, maybe you'll see a more accurate bid. It's probably going to go to somebody else, but it is kind of interesting to know that they're in that discussion. Now, you talk about Chris Davis, and if you want to, we'll entertain that notion for a minute. Buster Olney tweeted out today that the Cardinals have had 78 home runs in the last 4 years from their first baseman total combined, which is a little bit different than Mark McGwire hitting 70 in 1 year. Chris Davis has had 159 home runs over the same time period. So he's had, basically double what all of the Cardinals first baseman combined have. There's no doubt he'd bring power to this lineup, but can he bring anything else? I think that's the big question that anybody's going to ask.
Yeah, I mean, and this guy's going to command a 5 or 6 year deal over $130 million because he just had a great year for Baltimore. He really put together a great year. And you have the weariness of him hitting outside of the AL East, those hitter-friendly parks in Yankee Stadium in Fenway in Baltimore. And, of course, Matt Wintner made a great point last week about how the average distance of his home runs do carry enough distance for them to travel out of most and all ballparks, so there isn't that scare. But just imagining him coming over to Busch and maybe just hitting that blockade that Mark Reynolds hit. I know Davis is a better player than him, but they're very similar makeups. They hit a lot of home runs. They strike out a lot. And, would he thrive as well here as he would in Baltimore or in a hitter-friendly park? You know, playing in Busch Stadium 81 times a year, That's just the biggest threat. But you're going to give a lot of money to this guy. He's not going to be cheap. He's going to want a long deal for a lot of money. And, you just don't know how he projects. He had that year where he just kind of dropped, or all of his power dropped away, except for his, except for home runs. He didn't really do anything else. I mean, what if he comes to Busch and just that? And then you have him. I mean, it's not a one-year small deal like he had with Reynolds. It's a long deal you're going to have to deal with. And there's just that scare of what he can give you, not just next year, but, long term. He's going to want 5 years at least. I mean, that's what his agent's probably going to start out by asking. And is that really worth the stretch for Mazzal to do? I can't see John Mazzal going with that kind of player for that long with his kind of makeup. I just can't see him pulling the trigger like he would with Jason Hayward on a long deal because of what Hayward brings you all around in many facets of the game. So I think Davis is an intriguing guy. I mean, he's not too old. He's He's got a great power. He is what the Cardinals need in one side of the game. He does have power. He would fit comfortably into that cleanup spot. He would be a legitimate cleanup hitter. He would, you know, he would probably hit a lot of home. He'd probably hit more home runs than the Cardinals have in the last couple of years. I think Buster Olney's tweet is basically saying, well, since Albert Pujols left. Mm-hmm. And it's a very legitimate claim. The Cardinals, they had a problem in right field in 2014. First base was was a big problem this last year, even though Piscotty played a little better. It is kind of a dark hole for the Cardinals. I mean, we all know if Hayward returns, that Piscotty's probably going to play a lot of first base, and maybe it won't be. But I think that Davis is, as I said, if they don't get Hayward, he's one of those alternative routes that if Mazzanek wants to change the makeup of this lineup, change the way it goes about as far as going for power more than just getting on base and stretching the outfield and taking the extra base, stolen base like Hayward offers you. I think that's one way you can go. I don't think Davis is, that money that he's going to be commanding is very scary. I don't think he's worth it.
Yeah, I think power to me seems to be one of those things that doesn't necessarily age well. And again, I mean, he hits 250, 260. He strikes out a ton. It doesn't feel like a player that ages well. And so by the end of that contract for the money, like you say, that he's going to be commanding for a five-year deal, it has a feeling, especially, and I don't know his defense, I don't know what anything, but he don't have the DH spot to put him in the American National League. It just feels like that's as an American League player, that wouldn't necessarily work here. Now, if the Cardinals go out and sign him, sure. I mean, it'd be nice to have that kind of power. It would be definitely different, and, you know, maybe that would be what it takes, but it just doesn't feel like a good fit. Now, again, what do we know? But that's just my feeling on it. So we'll see. And as for Alex Gordon, I think I kind of like Alex Gordon better as a player, but an outfielder, draft pick, lots of strikes against him as well. And it seems unlikely. I know that Kansas City's hesitant to spend money, but can you really see Alex Gordon leaving Kansas City?
It's been one of those things that, you know, like today, he declined a qualifying offer, and he's had a test for agency. As far as, it just depends on how much of a price that he goes up for. I mean, a guy on Fangraphs, they say that he's going to command, you know, $20+ million. And if you look at his last four or five seasons, he had kind of an off year this last year. But as far as, you know, you kind of compare him to what Hayward can do as far as WAR, as far as, you know, maybe a lesser defensive player, more offensive. But yeah, I can see if his price gets too high. I don't think the Royals are going to pay him that money. I know that Johnny Cueto is going to leave there for sure, and Alex Gordon's one of those guys they might lose. But I think if he does kind of command a very high salary kind of deal, I mean, he's a 31-year-old player, so this is definitely his last big deal. I can see him pricing himself out of Kansas City.
Excuse me. Yeah, maybe so. You kind of look at his WAR, kind of bounces around. He's been a 6 WAR player 3 times in the last 5 years, but this year was a decline. And again, be 32 next year. 32 to, you're probably looking at a 5-year deal. So you're looking at 32 to 36, maybe 37 with some options. Could be interesting. I don't know. I don't know that he's. It will be interesting to see what people think about him when he hits the free market. I still think probably he winds up with Kansas City with some sort of deal, but maybe that's just, it'll be a little weird. It'll be a little strange to see Kansas City keeping, a homegrown guy. You're so used to them having to deal those off. I've always said that was the problem with people like Kansas City and some of these other teams. They could develop one or maybe two guys in their system, but that wasn't enough to put them over the top. Those guys get expensive and you have to send them off. What they needed and what they finally got was that full, you know, class of 5 or 6, 7, you know, young guys that could fill that whole thing up and hit at the same time, and that's what pushes you over the top, and that's what they've done. But then you come to the point of trying to keep all those guys, and that becomes a little different story. We've been getting close to an hour now. Thought about going over the Cardinal Blogger Award ballot, but I think we'll save that maybe for next time. We may need the content, but we'll be doing that. And I will, we'll see, if you keep an eye out on Twitter, probably this weekend or Monday, there will be a ballot for fans to vote as well on our Cardinal Blogger Awards, and those are kind of evenly split between things that happen on the field, you know, best player, best pitcher, best rookie of the Cardinals, you know, things of that nature. And then also blog awards, you know, best individual blog, best team blog, best podcast, which you could vote for us, or you could vote for somebody that actually deserves it. And so, and things of that nature. So we should have that out by Monday, and they'll have a couple weeks that you can vote on that. We would appreciate your input on the, on that when we get it going. Now, Dan, that means it's time for us to turn to the entertainment corner. What have you got for us this week?
Well, I finally got a chance to go watch. Of course, we all know James Bond's new movie Spectre comes out tomorrow, actually now, and I'm going to be previewing that. But I watched the Steve Jobs movie, and man, I tell you, I was really impressed by Danny Boyle's movie. If you only know Steve Jobs as the guy that really helped bring us the iPhone and the iPad and the iPad, this movie really gives you a peek into what made him tick and how his life was a lot more interesting and detrimental to himself than anybody would have thought. I mean, before I went into the movie, all I knew of him was this technology mogul who kind of helped change the way that we treat phones and tablets and all that stuff, and the way Michael Fassbender plays him and the way that Danny Boyle directs the movie. Aaron Sorkin is just a brilliant screenwriter. I mean, he writes. He's the guy that brought West Wing and he brought Newsroom and he started to write scripts like The Social Network and now with Steve Jobs. It's a movie that really makes you pause and think about where we were before he came along and where we are after. It's very brilliantly staged as far as the three launches of the Mac computer, Jobs' little project called Next, and then you have the iMac, and it really tells you that this guy had a lot of problems in his life, and he wasn't the most easiest person to get along with. And without getting melodramatic about it, Boyle and Sorkin really kind of let you peer into this guy's soul and kind of what made him work and how brilliance for a lot of guys comes at a cost. And Michael Fassbender, who most people know as the new younger Magneto, he really turns in a great performance. He, you know, as far as just look and mannerisms and kind of the way that he plays them, it's very nonchalant, it's very natural. This movie, I mean, this really reminds me that we are in the season of great movies. I've seen so many good flicks. I mean, Bridge of Spies, the Tom Hanks movie, The Walk with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, The Martian with Matt Damon, and now this movie. I mean, that's just back-to-back-to-back weeks of just great films, and this is a good time for cinema. This is when directors and producers, they save their biggest punches for October, November, and December, where the Oscars awards really get dealt out. So, but I mean, really, you can't miss right now. You can go watch The Martian, which is still in theaters. You can watch Bridge of Spies. But Steve Jobs, if you want to know the real story behind Steve Jobs and what made him tick and how he changed the way we look at computers and phones, this movie is a great ticket.
All right. Sounds good. That will do it for tonight, and we will be with you again in 2 weeks, right before the Thanksgiving holiday. We'll get this busted out here in a couple weeks. Hopefully, probably have a little bit more of this, 40-man stuff to deal with. Not likely. We'll know the qualified offers, that kind of stuff, but not likely to have a whole lot of free agent stuff done. Like we said, Mo likes to get it done before the turkey, but this year he's just going to have some unfinished business when he sits down for his meal. For Dan Buffa and Daniel Shopdog, we'll talk at you next time.